Diabetes Insights, Breakthroughs and Innovators. The EASD TV podcast from the annual meeting of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes.
Hello again. Now we come to one of our favourite sessions on EASD TV, where we talk about the future. So we've invited two experts to come in and chew the fat. And the session that we're going to cover, or the topic that we're going to cover today, is type 2. So I have with me Emma Ahlquist from the Lund University in Sweden and Matthias Bluhel from Leipzig University. So a diabetologist and a researcher.
Yes.
So, Matthias, paint us a vision of the future with type 2. Where are we going in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's the best example that the two of us are sitting here together, because I think clinicians learned a lot from basic research and from stratification ideas that didn't come from clinicians primarily, I have to admit. So the future of type 2 diabetes treatment are going into several directions, I would say. First of all, we need to define the disease earlier, differently, and we should take advantage of all the treatment modes to bring people with type 2 diabetes into a remission as long as possible.
So we've seen the rise and rise of GLP-1s. I mean, they dominate the headlines. Will there be a problem with governments, do you think, persuading them that they should be reimbursing these drugs because of their wider metabolic effects? And actually, government tend to think of them, partly because supermodels take them, as lifestyle drugs. Is that going to be an issue, do you think, for diabetologists, to persuade hospital systems that actually the cost of these drugs is really worthwhile?
This is one of the most important questions. We typically have, for at least some of the incretin-based therapies, two indications. One is type 2 diabetes, and this indication is typically reimbursed by many insurance companies. And the other is obesity. And there's only very few countries in the world who offer reimbursement, and some of the countries only offer it under certain circumstances and for a defined period of time. So, of course, it is difficult to distinguish whether obesity caused the type 2 diabetes or whether type 2 diabetes makes obesity treatment more difficult and worse. So, of course, it's always a weighing up what indication we use. Typically, reimbursement for type 2 diabetes is not a big problem for the majority of incretin-based therapies. For obesity treatment, there is a long way to go. First of all, many governments still believe obesity is not a disease, but just a risk factor for other diseases. We believe it is a disease. It's progressive and relapsing, and we may help a lot of people when we treat already obesity before diabetes, type 2 diabetes develops.
And the issue is often muddied and clouded by people thinking that it's self-imposed, that all people have to do is stop eating and exercise more, and of course we all know that that really doesn't work as an approach.
Every treatment strategy for type 2 diabetes, but also obesity, has its place, and also its phenotypes who benefit from it. So if you have a person who has like 5 to 10 kilograms of overweight, maybe abdominal fat distribution, then specific diet recommendations, exercise may be sufficient and very helpful and sustainable even. The majority of patients I see, then the average BMI in my outpatient clinic is 54,
you know, 54.
Have a severe obesity problem. And then we are talking about obesity surgery, metabolic surgery, and of course, treatment with medications.
So there's a lot of stigma there as well, isn't there?
There is.
So let me bring you and Emma, because if we think about the history of type 2, first of all, it was, oh, you haven't got the bad diabetes. You've just got a touch of diabetes, which is kind of ridiculous. And now we've got past that and thinking of type 2 as much more serious. And also, we're thinking of it not as a single disease, but actually multiple buckets of disease. And that's where you come in. Tell me about the work that's going on in your area and where it might take us in the future.
Yeah, so we have had a few years now with a lot of focus on precision medicine and how to take this huge heterogeneity of type 2 diabetes into some kind of structure and something that we can use clinically, hopefully. And so the work that we have done a machine learning approach to group individuals with type 2 diabetes into groups based on similarity, based on some very common and very basic clinical variables that are...
So it's clinical variables rather than genotyping, for instance.
Exactly. So we have used basically the usual suspects, so to say. So BMI, age at diabetes diagnosis, HbA1c as a measure of severity, and then measures of insulin resistance and insulin secretion, and grouped individuals by similarity using a cluster algorithm. And then we have compared the disease progression in these different groups and seen that they develop different complications. And we've also seen that especially some of them may appear to be a bit more benign than you would think because they have a relatively low HbA1c, they seem to have good glucose control, and they still develop a lot of complications. And this is especially the most insulin-resistant individuals that are also quite obese a lot of the time.
So do you see this approach becoming a standard one?
I hope so. So I think individualized treatment and the personalized medicine depends on phenotyping and on getting an idea what subtype of patient is sitting in front of us. And the concept Emma developed, I think, is validated already in clinical practice. We really see these subphenotypes, and we also think that patients belonging to one or the other phenotype might benefit from different treatments. For example, you have discovered that there are people with so-called type 2 diabetes which may have a deficiency in insulin production relatively early on, and those people would definitely benefit from earlier insulin treatment or substitution, if you want so. You also discovered a group which has like a more age-related, milder form of type 2 diabetes. These are the patients who may benefit from milder, if you want, so treatments such as DPP-4 inhibitors, for instance. But they also benefit from metformin SGLT2 inhibitors. The patients I see with obesity-related diabetes, with insulin resistance as the main background of diabetes, they benefit a lot from more recently discovered treatments such as SGLT2 inhibitors or incretin-based treatments. And that's an approach we already use in the practice. We would like to extend that to pre-diabetes, to obesity in the future. But I think we are right now only at the beginning to adapt the system you and the research group in Lund described.
Yeah, and I think especially this insulin-resistant group is important to realize that they have quite a large prevalence of complications, or should we say comorbidities, already when they're diagnosed. They already have a lot of kidney disease, cardiovascular complications, fatty liver disease, and so forth. And so maybe these would be then very beneficial if we can catch them and treat them earlier, to treat the insulin resistant that has probably been going on for many years before they get their diabetes diagnosis.
So we're seeing the incidence of type 2 diabetes exploding, and that's particularly true in the global south. How can we adapt some of these algorithms for use in low-resource settings?
Yeah, so that's a very important question, and it's a balance, right? Because for the easier the algorithm or the method, the easiest if you can just divide people on age or BMI or something else that is readily available, then that is very easy to implement. On the other side, if you have there are many people looking at different approaches with machine learning and omics measurements, then you can get a lot more precision. But on the other hand, it's much more difficult to implement, especially in poor countries. So the method that we have used, it requires you to measure C-peptide. So that's the limitation. The other things are normally used already.
I got very excited because we had somebody in here from the University of the Institute of Health at Luxembourg, and he was a diabetic epidemiologist, diabetes epidemiologist, and he had somebody who worked in AI, and they were using voice recordings to screen for type 2 diabetes. And they'd done a proof of concept trial in the US, 800 people matched, and some of them with existing type 2, and they found 75% of the type 2. None of them, all of those have been diagnosed with type 2 simply by getting them to read a piece of text into their phones and having the algorithm on the phone.
That's amazing.
It's astonishing.
I mean, yeah. The difference between the voice recording and your studies is, of course, that you had a pathophysiology idea behind it. So all the parameters included into your subphenotyping make sense in the trajectory of the disease or the history of the disease. But of course, we don't understand the entire pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes well enough to offer an etiology-based treatment. So that would be, of course, amazing to have some of these completely independent markers. We used a similar approach, not for the voice recording, but we had a look into adipose tissue. We just took a biopsy and did genome-wide scanning for gene expressions only in adipose tissue. And indeed, we find very similar to yours phenotypes the machine would give us. Phenotypes of healthier people, of really insulin-resistant people, those who have hormone disbalances, for instance, with cortisol levels, those who have with male and female hormones differences compared to other or healthier people. It's interesting that the machine can help us in the future also to identify maybe even pathophysiologies we are not aware of.
The other intriguing screening device I've seen whilst at the Congress is shining infrared light at people's nails in order to pick up the amount of, I think it's glycosylated chitin.
Oh, I hope it's not the feet. Food nails. That would be fun.
But why I was telling you this is because we know now that 50% of those, in general, 50% of those with diabetes or pre-diabetes are not diagnosed. So screening will become very important in the future, I imagine. Is that where you see efforts being concentrated in more screening?
Absolutely. You have seen all the advertisements, even in the subway here, for type 1 diabetes, actually, also screening. So this is, I think, also a big field and a huge advantage in the future to pick up those individuals with an increased risk for early development of type 1 diabetes. Same is true for type 2. So that's, I think, one of the major tasks, because we also, as clinicians, don't see these people because they don't have, that doesn't hurt, they don't feel anything or any symptoms. So we just have to rely on, let's say, parameters you included, and go to the usual suspects, to the families, and do a very early screening.
I want to close by asking each of you to just say what you think you might see if you came back here when in 2034 EASD is here again in Madrid. What do you think you'll see relating to type 2? Be wild, Matthias.
So if we will be here in a couple of years from now in Madrid for the next EASD meeting, I expect that we are much closer to an individualized and maybe even etiology-based, stratified, personalized treatment of people with type 2 diabetes.
Emma?
I agree. I also hope that we will see type 2 diabetes thought of more as maybe not exactly the subtypes that we have defined, but something like that. I also think we will see a lot of more complicated AI-based prediction models for selection of therapy and prediction of complications, and perhaps more treatment focusing on treating insulin resistance.
Well, there you are, a vision of the future. There'll be more on ESD TV very soon.
Thank you for joining us on the podcast of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. We hope you enjoyed today's insights. If you did, go ahead and hit subscribe and you'll always stay up to date with the latest in diabetes research and discoveries. And if you'd like to dive deeper, you can find plenty more information at EASD.org.